You're listening to a talk presented by the Brisbane City Bible Forum. This is the first of a series of talks entitled Abuse in the Church. Thank you for listening.
I should say that I guess as a Christian, someone who goes along to a church, who's a member of the church, if you've suffered at the hands of the church, be it sexual abuse, because we know that's the sharp edge of abuse in the church, or some other abuse, I want to say sorry. It's a terrible, terrible thing. And I'm sorry that's happened to you. And if there's people you know that's happened to, it's an awful thing. If you have a look on the City Bible Forum blog, I've written a little bit of response how I think Jesus would respond to the issue of abuse of children in the church. And so you might like to look at that. I suggest he says there'll be hell to pay on that issue. In May 2011, a study was released. It was a study and an investigation run by the US Catholic Church. And it was commissioned after the Archbishop of Boston admitted that he had protected a priest that he knew had molested children. So the US Catholic Church commissioned this investigation, and the report looked at the rise of sexual abuse starting in the 1950s and spanning 60 years. This was its conclusion. This is from the newspaper. I haven't read the report, from the newspaper, and it's a quote. He said, "The crisis of sexual abuse of minors by Catholic priests is a historical problem. With the rise in abuse cases in the 1970s, 60s and 70s, coming from, and I quote here, being influenced by social factors in American society generally." In the words of Karen Terry, she was the lead investigator, she said the 60s and 70s were a period that saw patterns of increased deviance of society. And so the church sexual abuse scandal developed in parallel to the decline in social mores. So according to the report, there were 11,000 incidents of sexual abuse by children by priests, that was in the US Catholic Church, reported since 1950. Did you catch that? The blame for what went wrong in the church was blamed on changes in society. Really? Really? Is that good enough? Is that the answer? Just because there were changes in, she said, the sexual deviance of society, that therefore the church changed along with it? I don't think that's the answer at all. Have you ever read an accident report for a mountaineering disaster? I rock climb when I get the time. And when you read most of these accidents reports, what you discover is that before the mistake, there was a preceding mistake. And a preceding mistake before that. So what you discover is that the party didn't have enough leaders, they didn't have enough experienced people on the team, they didn't start early enough, they didn't take enough rope, they didn't take enough equipment, they didn't have anyone trained to deal with the particular situation. Well, with the church, I want to suggest to you that it's a similar situation here. That before I talk about, I guess, the first mistake of the church, the religion removes temptation, I want to talk about a preceding mistake for just a moment. What has gone wrong? Well, I think a key preceding mistake is that the church has failed to listen to its own book, the Bible. When it got that mistake wrong, it was like not taking the right equipment, starting too late, and not having any experienced leaders. There's accumulation of mistakes right there. It could be actually because it's the Bible that created the church. As people came to understand what Christians call God's Word, the Bible, the teachings about God, then people gathered together and became the church. But at various points, the church has walked away from its word. And so, of course, it's going to go wrong. If the church had listened to the word of God, what it would have discovered is this. And these are, I think, are the two major elements, I think, in this problem. The power of human sexuality. That's the first kind of big issue, I think. The power of human sexuality. Let me read this out to you. This is the writings Paul, the Apostle Paul, wrote to the Corinthians. He said, "Now, to the unmarried and widows, I say, it is good for them to remain unmarried, as I am. But if they cannot control themselves, they should marry. For it's better to marry than to burn with passion." See, Paul is acknowledging here the power of human sexuality. He's saying, look, it's to their benefit, these women in the church, if they don't marry. And he goes on in the chapter to talk about what those benefits are. But he says it's a benefit to not be married. But if a widow, notice that, can't control herself, she should get married. He's saying human sexuality is so powerful that if the widows might not be able to control themselves. You know, when you open a magazine and there's an ad for a watch or a perfume, and it's worn by some smouldering woman, and she's looking at you like she would, you know, like to take your clothes off. She's burning with passion, like she almost can't control herself. She might look a little bit like this. Paul is saying, if there's widows in the church wandering around who might not look like that, but are smouldering like that, it's better to get married. Why? Because Christianity recognizes the deep, deep power of human sexuality. So much so that even writing to religious people, Christian people, and saying, you might desire to remain single, but your human sexuality is so powerful that you might not be able to. So which case, get married. So it's not just a thing for widows. In the section before that, Paul says this: the husband should fulfill his marital duty to his wife, and likewise the wife to his to the husband. Now, Paul here isn't talking about unpacking the dishwasher or mowing the lawn when he says fulfill the marital duties. Those are entailed in marriage, right? But have a look at the very next sentence. He says this: the wife's body does not belong to her alone, but also to her husband. In the same way, the husband's body does not belong to him alone, but also to his wife. And he goes on to say, do not deprive each other, except by mutual consent. And for a time, so you might devote yourselves to prayer, then come together again, so that Satan will not tempt you because of your lack of self-control. Paul is saying, get as much sex as you can. Well, actually, he's not quite saying that. He's actually saying, offer as much sex as you can. Don't withhold your body if you're married. Why? See the last sentence there in italics? Because of your lack of self-control. Christianity, biblical Christianity, reckons the huge and deep power of human sexuality. And not that it's just that it's very, very powerful, but it's very, very good when expressed rightly. This is from the very start of the Bible, from Genesis chapter 2. It says this: then the Lord God made a woman from the rib he had taken out of the man, and he brought her to the man. And the man said, this is now bone of my bone and flesh of my flesh, and she shall be called woman, for she was taken out of man. For this reason, a man will leave his father and mother and be united to his wife, and they will become one flesh. And the man and his wife were both naked, and they felt no shame. The great sin in the Garden of Eden that people refer to was not sex. God organized it, planned it. And you see that line, I haven't got it up there, but the man and his wife were both naked and they felt no shame. Their nakedness was rejoiced in. And Adam sings this little song, an ancient, you know, kind of song. This is now bone of my bone and flesh of my flesh. She shall be called woman, for she was taken out of man. I put it to you that this is kind of Gangnam-style, ancient Jewish, hey, sexy lady. That's what he's saying here. Christianity views human sexuality as very, very powerful and very, very good when it's expressed rightly in the context of marriage. So how does celibacy come into this? Well, Paul says this in 1 Corinthians again, in his letter to the Corinthians. He says, now for the matters you wrote about, it's good for a man not to marry. But since there is so much immorality, each man should have his own wife and each woman her own husband. I say this as a concession, not as a command. I wish that all men were as I am. But each man has his own gift from God. One has this gift, another has that. It's interesting, preparing for this, I read reports from various churches. Some acknowledge, now some churches hold a celibacy very strongly, some don't, especially in their leaders, and you can kind of work out who they are. Some church reports, the one commissioned by the US bishops, acknowledged that celibacy is an issue. But other reports have said that celibacy is not an issue. I think the churches that don't understand human nature at this point, that think that celibacy is not an issue, have failed. They've failed to understand what their very own book tells them about human sexuality. human sexuality is so powerful. And that's why religion doesn't remove temptation. It's so powerful that it can't fix that problem of sexual desire. It can't just take it away. Rules, regulations, rituals will not change what's at the very fabric of being human. But that's not the only issue. The next issue is the depth of human brokenness. See, even when we do see the right that we want to do, we cannot do it. That's what Paul, the Apostle Paul, says about humanity. He says, I do not understand what I do. For what I want to do, I do not do. But what I hate, I do. Paul reflects on reading the law in the Old Testament. And it says, this is how you should live. And Paul says, I can see what it says. And I can even see how I should live. But I can't do it. But I can't do it. And he goes on to say this a few sentences later. I know that nothing good lives in me that is in my sinful nature. For I have the desire to do what is good, but I cannot carry it out. For what I do is not the good I want to do. No, the evil that I do not want to do, this I keep on doing. How broken are human beings? We're so broken that we are not masters of ourselves. We're mastered by what Christianity calls sin. You felt that, haven't you? You felt that when there's something that you know that you shouldn't do.
No, not me.
Not you. And we're all individuals. Yeah. You felt that, isn't it? There's something you know you shouldn't do. And sure enough, somehow, dare I use the word miraculously, strangely, 10 minutes, 15 minutes, 20 minutes later, you find yourself doing it. Or there's things you know you ought to do and you're planning to do that are good and you want to do, and somehow you find a week later that that goodness is unfulfilled. You didn't do it. You think, oh, sorry, I meant to. We are so broken. We are mastered by the evil within us. It's a shocking thing to say, isn't it? But that's what Paul says about the human character. And I think it's captured pretty well by these two guys. Actually, that's the point, isn't it? It's not these two guys. It's the one guy. On your left is Smeagol. Lovely Smeagol with the wide, doe-like eyes. Who will do anything to please Frodo. And on the other side is Gollum. Who will do anything to thwart. And it's the same person. Now, in his case, he's mastered by the ring. Right? You know, Lord of the Rings. He's mastered by the ring. That's us, isn't it? Capable of tremendous good. Generally, if we're caught unawares, capable of tremendous good. But the good we plan to do, we so often don't do. And the bad that we hope not to do, we often do it. But there's another way to think about this. I can't remember who wrote Jekyll and Hyde. Do you remember, anyone know who wrote Jekyll and Hyde? Mary Shelley? Stevenson, Louis Stevenson, yeah. In that character, I mean, it's the same guy. And as you read the story, initially, Dr. Jekyll takes a potion to become Mr. Hyde, but then he stops taking it, and he starts to try and get control of himself. And he's sitting down on a park bench, and he says, finally, finally, the good has won. And he starts to take pride in his goodness. And suddenly he becomes Mr. Hyde again, because suddenly he's confident about his goodness, and that's the death knell for him. Paul goes on to say that when we want to do good, we fail. We're mastered by our own brokenness, and no part of our humanity is immune from this, including our sexuality. In fact, given how central our sexuality is to us, I think it's more likely to be affected. Let me read to you from Project Axis. This was a report put out in 2000 into child abuse. And this section is from a guy called Patrick Parkinson. He's a lawyer from Sydney University. And he's written this. And you can find Project Axis online. Just Google Project Axis. He says this. It's a characteristic of sex offenders that they have an extraordinary capacity for self-deception. Perpetrators of child abuse rationalise their abuse in a variety of ways. Some have convinced themselves that what they do is not morally wrong. Another common rationalization is to see the child as the seducer. Other offenders may see sex as an entitlement for the male in the household, or a right that is to be demanded if necessary. Some priest offenders rationalize their conduct in terms of a legalistic interpretation of the requirements of celibacy. So they say that, you know, sexual contact that isn't intercourse is okay, or that sexual intercourse with a male, it doesn't break the rules of celibacy. What's he saying? That human beings are mastered by their own brokenness, especially once we've capitulated to evil. So where are we at? Well, the power of human sexuality, the depth of human brokenness. And the reason I highlight those two things is that's why it's a mistake to think that religion will remove temptation. It cannot. The religious and the external cannot fix the problem. Religious rules will not fix the problem. The Bible itself, which is not a rule book, makes it clear that the rules in the rule book will not fix the problem. In fact, the rules in the Bible will just help you understand how wrong you are. And in fact, they kind of incite the heart. Religious institutions won't fix the problem. What I mean by this is that belonging to them, be they churches or schools or the City Bible Forum, belonging to them won't fix the problem, because it's an external thing. Our biblical Christianity has always believed this. In about 1000 BC, the Temple of God was built by King Solomon. It's where the Jews were supposed to meet with God. And how does it get described? This great religious institution where all the priests were supposed to bring people to know God. God describes it by the prophet Jeremiah as a den of robbers. And he says, you use the temple to justify murder, thieving, lying, and stealing. So Christianity, biblical Christianity, doesn't think that religious institutions will fix the problem. And funnily enough, the people who belong to the temple, the priests in the temple, say, we are safe to do these detestable things. So in some ways, religious institutions can open the door to giving in to temptation, because the human heart thinks, I'm safe. I belong to such and such a church, or I teach at such and such a Christian school, or I serve in such and such a way. No. Religion will not remove temptation. Why? Because religion doesn't change hearts. Let me give you an example from Hollywood. You know this gentleman? Religion will not change hearts. Jack Nicholson. He's married, or had children too, Sandra Knight, Susan Anaspash. I think he's only married one woman out of this list, but he's had children to the others. Susan Anaspash, Winnie Holman, who I don't know, Rebecca Broussard. He's almost also romantically linked to Michelle Phillips, Babe Buell, I don't know her, Janice Dixon, Rachel Ward, Lara Flynn Boyle, and he had a long-term relationship with Angelica Houston. Plus, another website, and I'm not quite so sure, this website seemed a little slightly dodgy, but it reckons he has romantic relationships, I'm not quite sure what that means, romantic relationships with 22 other women apart from this list. What's the problem here? Is it something external to Jack Nicholson? Or is it Jack Nicholson? It's Jack Nicholson, isn't it?
And what's his secret?
Well, he says this. At least Jack has some insight. He says, I've been in love in my life, but it always starts with obsession that lasts exactly 18 months, and then it changes. This is in print, right? So a word to the ladies out there that are still around. If I'd known and been prepared for that, I may have been able to orchestrate the whole relationship thing better. It's just the irony there. But he knows it's his problem is his own heart. But then what does he think will fix it? If I could just orchestrate the relationship a bit better, No, Jack, I think it's going to still go the same way. Because the external's not going to change the... Unless, of course, he's saying that when we start dating, this is only going to last 18 months, unless he's describing that's how he'd orchestrate it better. You think that's what he means? It's quite possible. It is Jack Nicholson. Yeah. Well, that's right. He could be. That's right. Could
be. Have to be very careful
and insightful. Yeah. So the problem's not external to Jack Nicholson. The problem is Jack Nicholson. Biblical Christianity has always argued that the problem with humanity is not one that can be fixed externally. Not by religious institutions, not by religious rules, not by religious blessings. In fact, one way to understand the whole Old Testament, which is the bit of the Bible written before Jesus came, was that religion, rules and regulations would never fix them. So God says this through one of his prophets to his people. He says, "I will give you a new heart and put a new spirit in you. I will remove from you your heart of stone and give you a heart of flesh. I will put my spirit in you and move you to follow my decrees and be careful to keep my laws." The Israelites had tried to live God's way on their own strength for 1,000 years, and that led to them being kicked out of their own land. And God says, the only way this will work is if I change your heart, something internal. It's interesting, this isn't just a problem for the church. I don't want to defend the church at this point. But in the recent news, sexual abuse has been highlighted last year through the BBC. The star at the BBC was his name, Saville, and by government-run institutions in South Australia. I mean, this is terrible to say, but no amount of rules and regulations will stop this from happening again. We do need rules. We do need regulations. We do need procedures. We do need accountability. We do need people to be brought before criminal law. But none of those things will change the human heart. What needs to be changed is the heart. And that's why biblical Christianity adores Jesus. He's the one who promised to change the heart. A lot more could be said on that, but that's not the point of this seminar. What I want to point out to you, I guess, is that if the church had understood some of these things, that its very own book tells it, it would never have done these things. It would never have moved priests or leaders to a new context. Why is that? Because a new context, a new diocese, a new group of people is just an external change. It hasn't addressed the heart. It wouldn't have allowed people who have failed in this area to continue to have a role that exposes them to the temptations. The church had understood the power of human sexuality and the brokenness. It would have recognized that human beings, even Christians, are very likely to stumble again in this area. So it would have taken them out of those positions. And I think they need to be. And I don't think the church has still understood this. On Lateline in November 2012, an article, a report was on there that three different priests from the Order of the Salesians had faced three separate allegations of serious child sexual abuse. And these priests were allowed to travel overseas while they're under investigation. And at that point of the investigation, they had not been brought back to Australia to face their accusers in the church. Did the church think that an external change of a new country or a new institution would fix the problem? If so, it's deeply mistaken. Shame on us. Shame on the church. Finally, I think the church needs to think again against celibacy. I was a bit surprised to see in some of the reports that the church said celibacy is not an issue. I think those reports are wrong. I don't have any credentials as a psychologist, a sociologist, or as a researcher. But given our society, given our hearts, given my own heart, I think they're just plain wrong. Well, what's the way forward for the church? Well, I think the conclusion is that the church needs to begin to believe again its own teaching about human brokenness. A famous reformer of the church said about Christian people that they are at the same time sinner and justified. And they are always a sinner and justified. So a Christian might stand right before God, but they're still a sinner. Perhaps a saved sinner, but still a sinner. We need to take again the power of human sexuality. We need to realise that these things can and do happen in the church. For quite some time, as the sexual abuse kind of came out in society in the 80s, I don't know if you noticed that, the church for a long time didn't think it had a problem. Patrick Parkinson reports on interviewing one bishop about sexual abuse in the church, and the bishop said, I just didn't think it was a problem that we had at all. And so when allegations did come up, they were ignored. Again, the church has lost sight of what it teaches about human brokenness. Patrick Parkinson, you might like to read him in Project Axis, has outlined a few things. He said we need to implement procedures and policies that address the needs and victims of abuse. Amen. He said the church, this is my point, I think the church should not be interested in protecting its own back at this point. It must discipline offenders. It must see these matters as criminal offences. It must have clear policies to deal with the complaints that arise, with formal staff, employees or volunteers. But most of all, I think the church just has to not protect its own back. It has to say, we've done wrong here and we'll do whatever it takes to fix the problem as much as we can. Not that you can ever go back on what's been done. Finally, I think what we need to do is take seriously the claims of Jesus that it's the heart of people that need fixing and that the external won't fix the problem.